Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to the Criminal Connection podcast. My name is Terry Stone, a.k.a. The Podfather. Today, we've got a very special guest, Frank Harper. He's a legend in British films. He was a star in Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. He was in Rise of the Foot Soldier, Football Factory, and he's been in lots of TV and film projects. So welcome to the Criminal Connection podcast, Mr. Frank Harper.
That's quite an introduction, Terry. Thank you.
Well, I just wanted to pipe you up, you know. But Frank, you know, thanks for coming on. Just really, a lot of our listeners and a lot of our viewers obviously want to know the real Frank Harper.
So, we were just talking about it before we started filming. I worked, people say to me, you know, why'd you do such convincing gangsters? Well, I worked down the road for 10 years at Smithfield. So,
so you're surrounded.
I'm surrounded by them. Yeah.
But what kind of got you into acting? You know, did you get it, do it from, I mean, growing up as a kid, what was your sort of childhood like?
Well, it revolved around football. So my dad was a professional footballer. It was mainly about football, but it wasn't until I got older and I looked back, I was obsessed with films.
Even I was going to say, your dad probably, he was a disappointment. I wanted you to play for Tottenham or Millwall.
Oh, you weren't playing for Millwall, yeah. So, but no, I think it skipped a generation of talent. But I went to a theatre in Deptford called the Albany Empire to see a band. And a guy called Trix Worrell sort of said to me, I want you to be my next play. And I'd had a few beers, so I said yes. I remember the first night, and there was like a rehearsal room next to the dressing rooms, and I think we got a 20-minute call. And this room had an emergency exit, and I seriously considered walking out the door and never coming back again. I must have stared at that door for a good 10, 15 minutes. I've never been so frightened in my life. But once you've done it once, it's like, it's, you know, it's a rush. And then funny enough, through Tricks Worrell Tricks co-wrote a film called For Queen of Country, and he got me a bit part in that. And I think the first time I went on a film set, I thought, that's a bit of me.
That Denzel Washington?
So my first scene in the film was with Denzel Washington.
Fucking hell, it's tough at the top, isn't it, Frank? The Equalizer.
I only had two lines, but my first scene in the film was with Denzel Washington, yeah.
But that's a great story. But when you did your first theatre thing, did you have any formal training, or was it just literally you was in it and was he like as a director, writer, whatever, Tricks Warren? Was it Tricks Warren?
Tricks Worrell.
Worrell. Did he sort of coach you? Did he sort of give you any tips? Or
no, we just did it. Yeah, we just did it. We just went on stage and did it. It's as similar as that, really. And I had no training at all. But I think that again, being at Smithfield, it's easy to be quick on your feet, you know, because there's so much stick flying around. Right. So you learn to be quick with a comment, you know, otherwise you get slumped.
So how long ago?
Like being on a set of foot soldiers.
Yeah. We'll come to that.
We'll come to that.
But what happened with when we did? You've obviously done his play now. You've done your movie role with Denzel. Oh. When was that? Was that?
So this was the '80s. So I did about five plays at the Albany, and we did a couple on tour. I did Shakespeare.
Who's your playing?
Well, this is the guy
that
directed
it. I can see
you
with that skull, Frank.
That's Hamlet. No, the guy come up. The guy cast me and two people like me as the three witches, and I went, "Well, I ain't wearing a pointy hat." He went, "No. I think Mad Max." So we had these great big broadswords, and they'd severed heads and stuff like that. I've never had so much fun in my life. It was brilliant. But I think that was a sort of. That was a big moment, that, because it's like a psychological thing. I remember coming on stage that night and thinking, I've done Shakespeare now.
I'm a proper actor.
I'm a proper actor now. The rest of it's going to be easy after doing Shakespeare. No, we did a couple of Shakespeare's, and we did a play that's not done very often called The Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uy, which, funnily enough, it's about gangsters in Chicago, but they're all based on the Nazi party. So wow. Arturo Uy's Hitler.
Right, okay.
So I played a character called Roman, which was Ernst Röhm, who was leader of the SA. So it was written by Berthold Brecht. So it was even then, I'm playing gangsters.
Right, okay. So pretty much your career was you're going to play gangsters. You played cops as well, didn't you?
I'm allowed to do cops. I could do cops, gangsters. And then the one I like to think, well, there's no acting required, which is Nice Dad. Every now and again, I get Nice Dad.
What do you agent mean, you, Frank? I've got a role for you. Am I killing someone or am I nicking someone? No, you're playing a nice dad.
And someone said to me once, that must have been tough for you when you did Bend It Like Beckham, playing such a nice dad. I went, no, that's me, that's my life. Well, all the women in it drive me mad.
Right. So after Queen and Country, you did some more plays, and then...
Well, I sort of...
Was that your big break, Queen and Country?
No, I sort of... I mean, I had to spit in a coffin for Queen of Country, but that's when I knew that's what I wanted to do. I just wanted to be an actor. I wanted to do films. So, I was about to pack it in. And I went for an audition for a film to play a market trader, for Young Americans. And if you're listening, Danny Cannon, you still ain't giving me a job. So. But no, it's an in-joke. But he... I thought, I'll get this. I knew the producer said, you'll get this. I didn't get it. So.
Thanks, Danny.
He's funny, Danny. He always said, I think I really like your acting, Frank. I said, well, give me a job then, Dan. Anyway, so I didn't get the job. And it was just before Christmas. And I thought, I'd sort of turned 30. I'm thinking, it's not meant to be. You know, I've had a go at it. And, but the casting director on that film, Sheila Trusice, was having a wine with Patsy Pollock, who was cast in another film. Patsy said, I need an authentic Londoner. Jim Sheridan, the Irish director, wants the real deal. So Sheila said, well, I'll see someone last week. He hasn't done much, but he's definitely the real deal. So I went to see Patsy, and she said, do you want to go and see Jim Sheridan tomorrow? So I went, yeah, fine. So... turned up at the Grove, and I walked into a suite there, and Daniel Day-Lewis is sitting there. So it's like Name of the Father. And I'm thinking, I'm watching him in Last of the Mohicans at the cinema. You know what I mean? About a month before.
You must have had to pinch yourself.
I did a bit, yeah. And then so we have a chat and so he said to me, where did you train? So I went, Smarda. And he said, what's Smarda? I said, the Smithfield Academy of Dramatic. So that broke the ice, that made him laugh, you know. And then Jim Sheridan said to me, do you mind doing some improvisations with Daniel? And that, I'll tell you what, Till, that's the moment where you just, time, I think, did stand still for a second there. Yeah. I thought, well, this could change my life. And, but I think because of the Smithfield thing, I didn't really have any fear. I was used to thinking on my feet, you know.
Daniel Wu.
Anyway, about an hour later, and Jim Sheridan's climbing over these really expensive Chesterfields at the Grosvenor with a camera filming it all. So I think it must have gone for about an hour. And he said, that's great. He said, can you wait outside? I went, yeah. So I walk outside. Patsy Pollock says to me, well, that went well. I went, what do you mean it went well? I thought I was coming for a chat. I've been improvising with him for an hour. And must have been, I don't know, about 10 minutes. They both wandered out, Jim and Daniel. And Jim said, do you fancy doing it? It'd be a crack. Come out. Promise you, you'll have a crack. Come and do it. It'll be fun. I went,
she like that? Oh.
I went, what, you want from in a job? He went, yeah. I went, all right. And then Daniel said, I'm really looking forward to working with you. And I went, not as fucking much as I'm looking forward to working with you. But the weird thing was, it was so long ago, it was before mobile phones. So I got, come out.
Otherwise, you'd have had that selfie, right?
I've had that selfie, yeah, absolutely. I come out of the Grove now and hit the first phone box. He's a Southall, better phone my agent.
People need to know, watching or listening,
yeah,
to this.
A phone box, it's like a glass thing with a phone in it.
It was red.
Yeah, you couldn't miss it. It was everywhere. So I thought, better phone my agent. I've gone blank. I cannot remember. The three numbers you always remember was your agent's number, your own number, and your mum's number. So I couldn't, it had gone, couldn't phone it. I thought, oh, phone my mum, tell my mum. So my mum and dad had a pub at the time, and that pub's number is 7712443, right? I can remember it to this day. Could I remember it? Nothing. It'd gone. I dialed the wrong number three times. I've completely gone blank. So I thought, oh, what do I do? So I phoned myself and left a message. So when you, and anyway, it said, when you wake up and read this message, it did happen yesterday, it weren't a dream. So that was the start of it. And it was like, I remember the first.
Were you worried though that you might not be able to remember your lines? You got this kind of amnesia.
I've gone blank. I've gone completely blank. So, and then I do, you know that thing, be careful what you wish for. I remember first day on the set, I'm thinking, oh, this is real.
There's no fire exits. There's no fire exits.
And he had us up improvising, Jim Sheridan. I mean, it was a brilliant gig. But, I remember Pete Postlethwaite standing next to me, the great Pete Postlethwaite. He went, you're right. He went, Pete, I've no idea why I'm here. And he went, you're here because you're the best man for the job, kid. Now just get on with it. That was it. That was all I needed. You know,
good advice.
Yeah. And every now and again, Daniel was great because he'd stay in character all the time. I mean, he didn't drop the Northern Irish accent ever. And we every now and again do a scene. I look at him and he'd just do that. And just say, yeah, it was all right. That's all I needed. But someone said to me once, you know, who's your favourite actor? And I always say Daniel Day-Lewis because I think he's...
Well, he also piped you up as well. And that's always good, isn't it? Because...
Yeah.
Someone like that, I mean, he's one of the greatest actors in the world.
I think as well, Terry, he's never sold out. Daniel does what Daniel wants to do, you know,
I know we're trying to get him in Rise of Footsteps, but he keeps saying no.
The trouble is, Terry, he'd won a year to get into character, but no, and I'm serious, because that I was talking to a couple of mates of mine, they said, who's your favourite actor? Daniel Day-Lewis. One of them said, but he couldn't play Billy Bright. I went, no, that's the point. He could. If he wanted to, he could. He might spend him a year getting into character and another 6 months, but he could. If he wanted to do that part, he'd do it. I mean, that's the genius. But I think he's retired again, hasn't he? But.
I suppose the thing is, though, once you've won all the Oscars and you've done, I mean, he played, obviously, in My Left Foot, I mean, that, if he'd that have done that,
me, that freaked me out.
If he'd have done that now, he'd have probably got cancelled.
Yeah.
But back then, I mean, that was just like phenomenal. And I mean, I remember watching people used to say to me, if you want to watch an actor, watch My Left Foot. And I watched it and I was like, fucking hell. And I think, yeah, what else has he got left to achieve? And it must be like being Bill Gates and you've got, you know, 100 billion in the bank. And then people say, do you want any more money, Bill? And he's like, no, not really. But I want to change the world. I want to do whatever. But yeah, he ain't going to want to earn any more money because he's got enough. And maybe that's with him. He's done it all. So
maybe. But the amount of time he takes to get in a character. I mean, I remember going and watching My Left Foot at the cinema and walked out about half hour. And my girlfriend at the time came, what's wrong with you? He said, that's freaked me out. He said, I'm watching an actor. I've just realised that's an actor. And that completely freaked me out. So how I got through the audition with him, I'll never know.
And I suppose it's just that thing, though. Like you said, you're on Smithfield's market. You've had all the banter. You've been, you know, it's that sink or swim thing, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it was. It was sink or swim. But it was, you know, you get that sort of life-changing moments, you know. And it's weird that, and just when I think it's all over with, something pops up, you know.
I think that's the big thing that a lot of people watching and listening to this podcast need to understand. You know, as an actor, I've read this great story about Richard Dreyfuss, and I think he is either 62 or 63 now. And there was a big article in I think it was the Sunday Mail, and it was going on about, you know, he's an Oscar winner, he's in Jaws, he's in all these amazing movies, worked with Spielberg, and then he's like, I ain't worked for 10 years and I'm skint. And you sort of think, wow, how the fuck did that happen? But I think what a lot of people don't realise is 95% of actors are unemployed.
Yeah.
And just because you're working with Denzel Washington or Daniel Day-Lewis doesn't mean you're set up alive.
Well, because you know the great story about Jaws. They offered, Spielberg offered Dreyfuss and Schrader either a flat fee or a cut of the film's gross. And they didn't know what to do. So they went to Robert Shaw, who was like the experienced actor, and went, take the flat fee. No one's going to see a film about a fish. I mean, it cost
and that
them.
Is the fucking worst advice you've ever heard.
What did Jaws
give? Who give that advice?
Robert Shaw.
Don't listen to Robert Shaw.
No, because he was like the experienced actor. Dreyfuss and Schrader were like, his, you know, one of their first roles.
Now the equivalent of what that film took would probably be a billion.
Yeah.
It's still going now.
It's one of the biggest grossing films of all time. But yeah, that was Shaw's actual words were, take the money, no one's going to watch a film about
a
fish.
That's like being in Star Wars going, who's going to want to buy these fucking characters? No one's going to want to have Star Wars toys. No one's going to want a Millennium Falcon.
Well, it was Alec Guinness, didn't he? He didn't realise he did it for a share. It was a share on everything. They're all the merchandise as well.
I mean, someone said that made him. Like, yeah. He could choose what he wanted after that.
Yeah.
I reckon he was tapped into the Force, though. I think the Force spoke to him.
I think the Force did, yeah.
Take the back end. But with your, you know, the Daniel Day-Lewis thing, I mean, when that film came out, it must have been surreal watching yourself on the big screen with him.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. I remember being at the premiere with Tony Denham because Tony was in it as well, and it was all a bit, well.
Would you say that film changed your life?
It changed my life in a sense that I never doubted myself after that. I could sort of be a decent screen actor. I never doubted that. There's always that thing in your mind that before you sort of get a breakthrough part, is it because I'm not any good, I'm not getting any work, you know? And that changed people's attitude when I walked into auditions.
I think, do you know what, even if you talk to movie stars, like big movie stars, they're still self-conscious. They still don't think they're worthy enough. They still don't think they're good enough, even when they are. Mm. And I think maybe it's... I thought about it, and I just think... I think people that are actors, if they actually walk around saying, I'm such an amazing actor, look at me on screen and I'm watching myself, there's got to be something wrong with them. I think you have to be critical. You have to basically look at yourself and go, how can I do it better?
All the time. I mean, I find it very difficult to watch myself. And sometimes it's only years afterwards that I can actually watch a film and look at it objectively. You know, I think it's about 4 years after it came out, I'm sitting, Lockstock, I think was on Channel 4, was on sort of terrestrial television, and I sat and watched it with a bottle of wine and thought, actually, this ain't a bad film. You know, just because it was, you know, when you're that close to it.
I think I went to see Lockstock twice, maybe three times at the cinema.
Yeah.
And you know, that film, I think the genius of it was, you know, it was the first comedy gangster film.
Italian job, probably.
That was well executed.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, it came at the right time.
I think it was a perfect storm for Lockstock. You know, its timing, it was the height of Britpop, it was the height of the Lads Mags. I think the timing was right. People were still going to the cinema. You know, and to be fair, they backed it. You know, I remember going into a pub to watch the football on a Sunday, and they was advertising the film in the half-time, which has got to be the dearest ad spot, I would have thought, half-time, you know, on the Premier League. So they did back it. But it was... But people talk about it a lot, but it was very difficult. It was very difficult when you was outside, inside looking out, when it all came out. You know, it was a bit of a blur. But I remember walking onto the set for the first day, and I'm not gonna embarrass him. But one of the actors that I'd known a while said, "I don't think it's gonna be much, Cop Kid." I said, "Why's that?" He said, "They're shooting on Super 16, not 35mm."
Was he Robert Shaw's mate?
It's Robert Shaw's mate, yeah. There is a connection, but I won't go there. But and of course it was low budget. I mean, you probably wouldn't think it's low budget now, but then it was. And someone else walked on. I ain't going to embarrass him either. He came down to visit me on set and said, "I don't think this is going to be much, Cop. Frank's a bit cheap." Do you know what I mean?
So, would you say, I know you've obviously done some great work with Denzel and, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, but would you say Lockstock was the big break then?
I think Lockstock was life-changing in the sense that suddenly, when you walked into pubs, people stared at you.
I started quoting your dialogue,
yeah. So that was, and obviously where I grew up, walking into pubs and being stared at wasn't a good look. No, it was strange. And I think it was, my cousin said it to me. He said, you know, we grew up with our dads quoting movie lines. You know, we quote movie lines. He said, it must be really weird when people quote your lines. I never thought about it like that. You know, but yeah.
So how did you get the role in Lockstock? What happened?
Well, I'd gone out to do I've been out in Ireland doing a TV show called The Governor. And it was a good show, it was well paid, and I kept banging on about doing the third series. And I remember saying to, because everyone's frightened to ask Linda LaPlante, I just went and asked, "We're doing a third series?" So she went, "Yeah." And I'd signed a contract there and then. And anyway, I went for two castings in the space of 2 weeks. The first one was for 24/7, which was Shane Meadows' first movie, and then Lockstock. And I got offered 24/7. And my agent went, "Well, you can't say yes because it might clash with the governor." I went, "I want to work with Bob Hoskins, sod the governor." Do you know what I mean? And funnily enough, that third series never happened. And then out of the blue, I got a phone call saying, "Oh, you've that film Lockstock, you've been cast in it. And that you're playing a character called Dog." And I went, "I never auditioned for that." Anyway, they sent me the script. And
you said, "I'm not dressing up as a dog."
They sent me the script. And I remember sitting out in the garden reading and thinking, "Well, that's one of the best parts in the film." And I think, I don't know if it's true or not, but the urban myth was Ian Glenn turned it down. So, Ian, if you're watching, cheers, mate.
Yeah, thanks, mate.
Well, he did. The guy, he did get Game of Thrones, didn't he? So, yeah, yeah. He's not out of pocket.
Yeah.
But
I think, you know, sometimes in life, you know, people turn things down for whatever reason. I mean, there's probably 100 actors that have turned down roles that they wish they'd have done.
Yeah.
Like the guy who said he didn't want to sign the Beatles, you know.
Yeah. No, well, I think that was life changing in a sense that suddenly. You know, but it was strange though, because I was sort of, when the film came out, I was pretty much straight away, I was back in Nottingham doing another film with Shane Meadows, doing Romeo Brass. So
he's great. I've never met him or worked with him, but I love his movies. And that was a great movie, Romeo Brass.
Yeah, I think, that was sort of, it's strange because I did 24/7 with Hoskins and he was brilliant. I mean, he was, you know, So I think by the time I got to Lockstock, which was about 4 or 5 months later, I was sort of, you know, my confidence was sky high. You know, I sort of been, you know, worked with Bob and
Denzel and Daniel and not name dropping.
I'm not name dropping. Anyone sitting and go, "Cock, couldn't that up a name drop?"
but the thing is, do you know what's great though? The fact that you've actually worked with them. I mean, you know, yeah. I'm sure most actors would give their right arm to have been able to have, you know, worked with these people. You know, even if it's just one scene, like you said, with two lines, it don't matter. You're still.
Yeah, no, it was, and then after that it went downhill.
Have you got any funny stories on Lockstock?
Yeah, can I tell them? That's the point.
I'm sure you can, not name any names, you just edit it slightly.
Yeah, well, how can I put it? Paul Moriarty wound Lenny McLean up one morning, and when I got to the set, Moriarty gets in the car as I'm getting out of it, laughing. So I've just wound McLean up. And he weren't letting anyone in the freeway. And so I said, well, can't you film around? He went, no, Jason Fleming's costume's in there. And anyway, he knocked, Matthew Vaughn said to me, well, you know, Lenny, knock on the doors. Yeah, I knocked on the door. And I can't really tell the rest of it because I'll get cancelled.
Oh, well, yeah.
I'll get cancelled, yeah. If I tell the rest, it'll get cancelled.
Don't you want to get cancelled, Frank? No.
I'll definitely get cancelled. No, I will get cancelled. Yeah, no, I can't.
Not tease this everyone now, Frank.
Not this day and age. Someone have wound Lenny up about Jason's sexuality.
Right, okay.
That's that, and... Well, Moriarty had.
Right, okay.
And it wasn't true.
The thing is, though, just to put it out there, right, this shit happens on film sets all the time. Everyone has a banner, everyone has a life, everyone likes to wind people up. And for those of you that don't know Lenny McLean is, he was a fucking bare knuckle fighter, doorman, debt collector, enforcer. I mean, he was a scary guy, right?
Yeah.
So to make them sort of jokes around him, you know, he probably wouldn't. Bearing in mind, this is 25 years ago.
25 years ago, yeah. Right?
So obviously 25 years ago, people would be really offended by that. So, and they wouldn't have been thinking, nah. I've got to be diverse, I've got to be politically correct. So
anyway, I got the job of knocking on the door and calming Lenny down and telling him that it wasn't true.
How'd you talk him down? Did you just go, it's all a joke, Lenny. It's not really. He didn't really say you had a nice ass. He didn't really say that.
I just said, Len, Moriarty's winded you up. Is he? What a lot of fucking see him. Yeah.
He is funny though, PH. He's great.
He's he can tell a good story, PH. Yeah. But there's a connection there with Roy Shaw. Robert Shaw, rather.
Oh, right, okay.
The Jaws connection.
Right, okay. any other funny stories, or was that the main one?
We had to when the girl fires the Bren gun in the drug house, they squibbed this set they built at Camden. And Guy sort of said, look, well, I can only do this once it's squibbed, so everyone's got to hit their marks. So I said, we ain't got to worry about me, Ronnie Fox, it's Steve Sweeney you got to worry about. You better keep him out of the pub. So they locked him in a freeway, so he couldn't go in the pub, so he hit his mark for when they fired the Bren gun. And then there's a bit where I throw him, and his head goes through the wall. I don't know if you remember that bit. And Sweeney being Sweeney, he's going, give some willy, Frank, give some willy. I went, Steve, I said, all right, fine, just calm down. So all you got to do, Steve, is put your hands out, stop yourself, and then we'll cut. Give some willy, Frank, give some willy. So we do it. No, you need to do harder. So by this point, I'm getting the ups, I've launched him. And he's forgot to put his hand out, gone smash into the wall. So we had to stop filming for about 2 hours. He's got bird's eye peas on his face, get the swelling down. Yeah, but he didn't put his. No, we had some laughs on that. It was a good atmosphere. You know, it was a real sort of laid show. You know,
we had Vass on here, who played Roy Breaker in that film, and he was saying, like, when you had the premiere in Leicester Square, it was sort of surreal, like, you know, you had sort of Madonna wandering about. You know.
Dustin Hoffman, yeah, I know, that was a bit surreal. That was a bit surreal. Dustin Hoffman sort of come up and said, I really enjoyed your performance. I said, oh, you're about 30 then. Yeah, no, it was a bit surreal. It was a bit surreal. It was all a bit sort of, well, you know. Then again, the name of the father premier was pretty big as well. There's some faces
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
There was a few faces there out in Dublin. Yeah.
Because there was some aggro at the premier, wasn't there? Did Nick have a fight with somebody? Or
Nick decided to have a fight with a photographer who pushed him out of the way because he wanted a photograph of Dustin Off. He wanted a photograph of Dustin Off and not Nick.
Because that made the, I mean, I thought, I always wondered whether that was a PR stunt because I thought, what a great PR stunt. It was in every paper, wasn't it?
Maybe it was. Maybe it was. I don't know. But yeah. Because we didn't even see the film because cinema was packed. So we was just sitting drinking. And
when did you know that was going to be a big film, or didn't you? Or you just come out the cinema and then you get the phone call saying, wow, we're number one at the box office. You've just done 10 mil.
Well, do you know, it was funny. One person at premiere come up to me who I'd known a long time, and which was Keith Allen. Keith come up to me and went, that performance is something else. This film's going to go massive. And Keith's always been a cynical fucker anyway. So for him to say it, I thought, oh, it must be good then. Right. Even there, he's winding me up. Yeah, no, I think that was him saying that, because I'd known Keith a long time. I've known Keith back at the Albany Theatre, so I've known him a long time.
And then after Lockstock, what happened next? When was your next?
Well, I did a room for Romeo Brass with Shane, and then I just sort of ticked, I think, too far. Then I found myself working with Michael Caine, which was another massive highlight for me, really.
What film was that?
Shiner.
Right, Shiner.
Yeah. It was me and Andy Serkis played his two minders, you know, but it was... But it was one of the unit drivers. His brother worked at Smithfield, and he knew that, so he knew he could give it to me.
Right.
Because his brother worked at Smithfield. And every time I see him on a job, he drove me on a thing called Boys Unlimited, which was a spoof, Channel 4 spoof documentary about putting a boy band together. And I remember, and
you weren't in that, were you?
What?
The boy band.
I was the manager, but James Corden was. James Corden, one of James Corden's first jobs. So, and it was, we made that a year after my daughter was born. But you can see it on Channel 4 now. And I was showing it to her one day. You went, we wouldn't get away with that now, Dad, would you? It just shows you how the world's changed. But it's...
It is mad though, isn't it? Like, yeah. if you look back over... I mean, I think it's good that, you know... the world's moved on, and I think it's good that people are, you know, giving people opportunities that wouldn't normally get opportunities and creating, you know, a different environment for people to work in. But I do think, you know, some of the stuff in the 70s, when you look at it now, you can't believe that ever went on TV. But some of the stuff, like even now, like if you make a film, you know, and to anyone watching this will sound crazy, right? But you've got to think, when we make this film, whatever these people say and do in this film, will it be right next year when the film comes out, or will it offend somebody? And it seems now that people are being offended by nothing. It's like, you know, they're looking to be offended by anything, and the world's gone a little bit crazy.
Well, the thing, I remember someone saying, making a comment about St. George's Day, saying that the characters in it weren't politically correct. I mean, were they gangsters? I've never met a political gangster in my life. They're gangsters. What do you expect? That's what they do.
I mean, yeah. I mean, the reality is, right, if you are a working class lad or you are a gangster, right, and you're in that environment, you know, the dark humour, the banter, it all, like you said, working at Smithfield Market, I mean, you know, I'm sure if they recorded the conversations that went on there, they'd all be cancelled.
I think... I always remember my first day at Smithfield, and my granddad, I was with my granddad and my uncle, and I remember my granddad saying to me, what you got to remember, son, is no one talks to each other like this outside of the market. Only people that work here talk to each other like that. But, you know, and it, when I think about it now, it wasn't bad, it was abuse.
But it's the same when we've been on films. I think everybody... I think if you're on a gangster film, especially, the level of sort of testosterone and the banter and all the fucking about and the practical jokes, I think that obviously is all part and parcel of being in character. And I think a lot of the actors will use that as an excuse, saying I was in character.
do you know what? It's weird. I always remember I'd gone to a barbecue. Neil Maskell had a barbecue at his mum's house. And I think we'd just finished Football Factory about 2 weeks before, 3 weeks before. And Neil's mum, Pauline, said, I'm so glad that film's over. You lot have been horrible for the last 3 months. I went, really? She went, oh, yeah, you've been horrible, all of you. So she's talking about me, Danny, Neil, you know, Roland. You know, she said, you've all been horrible. She said, just horrible. I'm like, oh, right, okay. So even subconsciously, you know.
No, but, I mean, so someone asked me about it, and they said, why do you think when people are playing these roles, they become rude, mean, aggressive? I said, when actors learn the lines, they have to probably read and say out loud 1,000 times each line, right? So I said, if you're sitting in the room going, you muggy cunt, you fucking cunt, I'm opening you up, I'm going to do you, you mug and all this. If that's all you're doing for like fucking 6 weeks and then you get on the set, it's like you've brainwashed yourself into becoming a lunatic. So when they sort of, like, it's like lighting a firework and letting you go.
Yeah.
And I think you also, when you're not filming, I don't know if you've done this, but you become fucking short with people. So when people say something to you, like, what are you fucking saying? People are like, going, I'm just.
Yeah. I think I'm getting short with people's shelves. I'm getting old and miserable. I think that's all it is.
No, I thought I am as well. We're all the same.
I just thought I'm getting old and grumpy.
How old are you now, Frank?
I'm 60. I was 60 last year.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm 52 and I'm getting the same. So is it the grumpy old gets?
I was big 60 last year. Yeah, but. No, it does subconsciously stuff creeps in. I think you're right. Yeah. You know, and I remember Nick Love saying after 2 days on the Football Factory, this crew's either going to get used to us or walk off. So it was pretty full on. It was pretty full on.
So when did you meet Nick Love?
First met Nick on Goodbye Charlie Bright. Wow. So I did a bit on Goodbye Charlie Bright. And then we started the Football Factory, and the director they originally didn't work out, which is a long story that I'd forgotten all about until Steve North reminded me about it not long ago, and I thought I'd put that to the back of my head. But
was that he just wasn't delivering, or he just
they? I've always tried to sort of not slag people off in this industry because there's no point. But he'd shot a week, and Vertigo didn't like the rushes.
But that's not anything bad against him. It's no. The production company.
No, I think me and Steve got blamed for him when it was actually nothing to do with me and Steve. It was a decision that Vertigo took. And I remember suggesting to Alan Niblow, you should talk to Nick Love because about redoing it, if you're going to carry on. Because he does know that culture. And that's the problem. You know, you need, for something like that to work, you need to know the culture. I mean, you don't have to be a football hooligan, but you need to know the culture. We need to have grown up and been around people. So I think that's where he was clever with Nick's casting, was the people he cast knew the culture. Yeah. You know, so.
Well, the Football Factory was and still is probably one of the greatest football hooligan movies. I mean, ID was great. The Firm was good, but that was a standout. And ID and The Firm was a while back, but I think in the 2000s, there hasn't really been. I know Green Street came out, but that to me was more like a sort of Hollywood. And when Mr. Frodo turned up, I couldn't get my head around it. I was like, what's Mr. Frodo doing in this film? But then Football Factory, for me, as a true crime football hooligan, growing up on The Firm and ID and them types of movies, when I watched it, that was the film, in my opinion. So I think that was one of Nick's greatest films he's made.
I think if the aliens do show up, which evidently they're going to be
here, mate. They're walking amongst us.
Walking amongst us. But if you want to describe to someone, explain them football hooligans, you know, you'd show them The Football Factory. And also it's quite underrated because it's a social commentary film. It's about four different generations of men, working class men. And I think people, it's a film about football hooligans. There's a bit more to it than that, you know. Because you've got the four different generations, obviously Dudley and John Junkin, me and Tony, Danny and Neil and Roland and Callum, you know. So it's four distinct generations of working class men. I think it does explain it.
You must have some funny stories about the Football Factory. There's got to be a funny one. Or two.
Or ten. Or ten. I think I always remember the scene, the old Durandat scene. When we read that, me and Roland instinctively knew that was going to be potentially a big scene, you know, Steeler. And he said to me, do you want to rehearse it? I went, it's not rehearse it, Rose, just do it. Like, you know, just don't think about it. You know, I always find something, less is more. Sometimes the more you think about something, the harder it gets. But, and then we were supposed to film it, I don't know what it was, on the Wednesday. And then we had lunch and Nick went, oh, there's been a change. I want to shoot that after lunch. Is everyone all right with that? I thought, perfect, because you've got no time to think about it. Then Maskell pipes up and goes, we ain't got a lot of time to repair. I went, Neil, you got one line. One line, Maskell. But, I think the, at one point when we shot the big fight stuff, it was, let's all say all the extras were the real thing.
Yeah.
So, they all took, it was like build it and they will come, and they just sort of like suddenly appeared because it was right behind Millwall's ground. So I knew virtually knew a lot of them. And then the next day, they actually had real police riot stuff. And at one point, a few of the extras went, let's just do the old build. Oh, it's going to go wrong. It's going to go so wrong. And they meant it as well. It was pretty full on. Pretty full on, but there was quite a few wind-ups. I mean, the best one, Tanner slaughtered me, because obviously we was taking the mick out of his trousers he had on for the big fight scene. I can't remember. He had his
trousers. Got him in fathers, right?
No, then because straight away they all sort of went in and no one likes, we don't care. And I'm kind of dumb because obviously Mill's my team, you know. Yeah, but there was a few wind-ups flying about on that one. Yeah, again, you know, I've got to be a little bit careful as we get cancelled.
Right. God,
I know. It's terrible, isn't it?
We'd have done this 10 years ago. We could have shared all this shit with you, but we're so careful now.
It was a boys, very much a boys film. That we had a lot of laughs on that. You know, a lot of laughs.
And then I think the first time that we actually crossed paths was on Foot Soldier, wasn't it?
Foot Soldier, yeah.
And I think when we had the script and we was putting together, like, you know, who was going to be in it, obviously Craig was going to play Pat Tate.
Mm.
We had me playing Tony Tucker. We had Roland playing Craig Rolfe. And then you and Billy Murray were playing Jack Steele and Worms. And we didn't have an actor for Carlton. And it was actually quite funny because fast forward like 10 years and I was in Vegas and I met Statham, and he was actually with some friends of mine on the table, and we was all having a drink and having a laugh. And we went and had dinner at Hackstown, and we were all sitting around the table chatting. And he actually said, that Foot Soldier film was so fucking good. He said, I can't believe you didn't fucking get me in that movie. And I said, mate, I said, you'd have been great as Carlton, but I said, you wouldn't have liked the £380 a day. He went, is that all you pay, you tight cunt? But we were just having a laugh. But we obviously ended up with Ricky Harnett, and he played that part. But I always remember, because there was a scene in Rise of the Foot Soldier, and you come over in the, you had like these like blue dungarees on, and we were rehearsing the scene. You come over to the car, and obviously we're all trying to, but because we're all like pranking and fucking about, when you come over, I was like, fucking hell, it's Minty from EastEnders. You went, fucking Minty, you can't. It was just like, and that's how we sort of met. And then we just had a bit of a laugh. But I mean, I think that film, I mean, we did have a good laugh on that film, didn't we, Frank? I mean,
I think that was one of the most cinematic. Because we was actually in Epping Forest that night, weren't we? We was only not far, a couple of miles from where it happened.
Do you remember how cold it was as well?
I do, and I remember so being reintroduced to Bovril as a hot drink by Billy Murray. He went, took me back to Smithfield. He went, I've got just a thing with a cold, Frank. Bill pulled out a jar of Bovril. Hot Bovril, mate. That's the way forward. But that was... that was incredibly cinematic. That they did a great job on that when it was all lit up with the
Gilberts. They done a good job.
Yeah, and the snow effect was amazing.
And do you remember the everyone was doing the cliffhanger impressions, weren't they, around Craig? It's just that funny. I mean, if you was, it's a bit like probably Smithfield, isn't it? If you was on a Foot Soldier film set, you'd be like, "Why are these people being so rude to each other? Why are they saying this stuff?" But it was just funny.
No, it was good at the time. But it's interesting to talk about Statham. Last year, I was directing some young actors at the International School of Screen Acting, and he was there doing Expendables 4 or 5, whatever it is, with Stallone. And one of the kids, Jason Statham's just walked past. Which way did he go? And look, boy, I said, I'm going to say hello to him. So he looked at me like I was mad. Anyway, long story short, I found his trailer. And I said, can I say hello to Jason? I'm an old friend. He said, who is it? I said, Frank Harper. And inside the trailer, Frank, come out, give me a big hug. You know, asked me what I was doing. And then I said to do us a favour, come and say hello to these kids. They'll make their day. And of course, I will. Put his coat on, walk down to where I was working, said hello to the kids. I was like,
but do you know something? I don't know him that well, but that day and night that I was with him in Vegas, I just thought, what a lovely man. Down at Worth, one of the boys, couldn't do enough for you.
Well, I hadn't seen him for years. You know, when I see him that day at Three Mills, I hadn't seen him for years. So, you know. But no, fair play. We come see a lot of these kids made their day, you know. A lot of people wouldn't have done, you know.
Sorry, I'm busy.
Yeah.
And I'm being a movie star.
Yeah.
What happened? Have you got any other funny stories from Foot Soldier? Because I know obviously he probably enjoyed you shooting me, Roland, and Craig in the face.
That was that. Yeah, I mean, I felt a bit sorry to Roland.
You did. I remember when you shot me, you did say, fucking Minty, bang.
I had no problem shooting you and Fairbrass.
I was like, sorry, Frank, I was only joking.
No problem shooting you and Fairbrass. No, it's... I think it was all too cold, weren't we?
It was freezing. It was like minus four or something.
It was ridiculous.
Yeah. And because the director wanted us to all, you know, experience what it felt like, we was in that field or in that about dirt track in that in Epping Forest. And I think it was
about 3 nights you're doing that?
Was it a week?
We started as long as
yeah, because what they did was they did the killing with, because if you remember, there was
three versions of it.
There was you guys as Worms and Steel. There was the Hexel brothers killing, and then there was the police killing. So there was three.
That's right. That alternate three versions, endings, yeah.
And they had to do it all in the forest.
Because it was awkward. Because that at that point, Steel and Worms was still. You know, they were saying we didn't do it. I mean, someone told me in the week, is that true? Still double A cat. He still won't say he done it.
Well, there is also a rumour that Nipperellis' dead dad did it. Exactly. Yeah. Nipperellis' dead dad did it. But that's all been dispelled as a myth.
Right.
And obviously there's been another Sky documentary about the Essex boys who killed them, and there's some more conspiracy theories. But when we made that film, you know, the people that were in jail, Worms and Steel, they were doing a life sentence for the killings. The rumours were, a firm took them out, the rumours were the police did it because of Leah Betts. So when you look at this whole thing, it was like, we don't know what happened, so let's just go with three alternative endings.
The only smart way, it's actually the smart way of doing it, the fairest way to do it. I think Julian said to me, we're going to do three different versions.
Yeah, let the audience decide. Yeah. But what that did is it created like 20 books and 24 films.
Well, the thing is, there's been more films made about them three than John Gotti and Al Capone put together. They were proper gangsters.
That's what I mean. It's mad, right? And I remember talking to people from that era, and I actually said to them, I said, if I'd have told you, because when all this stuff was going on, I was running all the big dance parties, right?
Yeah.
So I actually said, if I'd have actually said to you at that time in 93, 94, 95, you ain't to believe this. You know these guys that are gang and terrorising people in Essex? There's going to be 20 films, 20 books, and we're going to be talking about this for like 20 years. People be like, well, you're mad. Who cares, right? But But it's for whatever reason, it's captured the public's imagination. And even today, the only people who really know who did it are the ones who got shot, right? Because Williams are still saying they didn't do it.
Yeah.
Other people were saying they did. Other people were saying somebody else did. And it's probably one of the greatest conspiracy theories. And it's probably never going to be solved.
A bit like JFK.
It is. Maybe an alien. Maybe an alien.
Maybe it was aliens.
Aliens did it.
No,
see, guys, that's a good conspiracy theory.
Well, aliens.
Yeah, yeah. They could have been. They could have beamed down.
I think that's the next one.
If I said foot soldier in space, that'd be good. That'd be good.
No, foot, I think we should undead. Reshoot it, but aliens kill him. I think that'd be good.
But you could have Rise of the Foot Soldier in space, right? And then you could have Rise of the Foot Soldier and Deb, where they come back to life and they're just walking around going, so,
or you could do Rise of the Foot Soldier the musical.
See, that'd be quite good. I mean, you can imagine that.
That'd be good.
Yeah.
I can see Craig doing a song and dance number.
He'd be like, you fucking can't. It would be funny. I mean, look, if you'd have told me there was going to be 6 Rise of the Foot Soldier films and a computer game, I'd have probably said it's never going to happen. But the fact we're sitting here now and they're talking about doing Rise of the Foot Soldier Ibiza, anything is possible.
Alexa, there's another one.
I mean, it's obviously Rise of the Foot Soldier Vengeance is the one that's just come out, and that's more like a Pat Tate sort of spin-off.
Right.
And what they've done is they've obviously killed off some of the main characters in that. But that doesn't mean they won't come back, as we've seen from Rise of the Foot Soldier 1. And they introduced new characters. So Jeff Bell was in the new one, the rapper RD, Sadie Frost. So there's been a few new people that pop up in this one that haven't been in the Foot Soldier universe, if you want to call it that. but it is crazy. I mean, the whole thing's... Frank Harper. So you might have worked with Denzel, you might have worked with Daniel Day-Lewis, you might have worked with Bob Hoskins, but you've been part of the Foot Soldier universe.
Well, I was asked to do 3. And I said, I don't really fancy doing it. And they went, well, let me tell you the concept. I've gone, it's set 10 years before the first one. So I did point out that...
He was a little bit older.
The first one was 10 years ago, which made everyone 20 years to be able to play that part. Right. Yeah, but...
We miss you on that one, Frank. It was a good laugh. But do you know what's mad? Like, when the lockdown happened, I got the call saying, we're definitely going to do Tony's Huck Story now. And I was like, oh, great. Yeah, Vinny's going to be in it. I was like, oh, cool. Craig's going to be in it. Ryan's going to be in it. It's been a really good laugh. Keith Allen was going to be in
Keith
it.
Keith was in it. Yeah.
So I was like, fucking fantastic. Yeah. And they said, it's a prequel. So I was like, that was 16 years ago. So I've got to be, like, 26 years younger. And I said, it's...
Yeah, but if it's the Foot Soldier universe, it doesn't matter. No, does it?
I'll be honest with you, right? You get the trolls going, oh, you know, a 50-year-old playing a 38-year-old and all this. Oh, why don't you get someone else to play the part? And it's like, well, somebody else wants to play the part, let them do it. But unfortunately, for the trolls, people like the people, you know, if you'd have come back in that film as Worms, nobody would have gone, oh, too old. You'd have had the trolls going, too old. But the Foot Soldier fans don't give a fuck. They buy into you, Billy Murray, me, Roland, you know, Craig, whoever. So I think, you know, that's...
But I think we were talking about the other day with film actors, and most of the big stars just play variations of themselves anyway.
Especially now, because now it's sort of like, well, you can only play this part. You're not allowed to play anybody else.
You know, and also people talking about accents as well. Well, the 3 biggest British movie stars growing up, for me, were Michael Caine, Richard Burton and Sean Connery. And they never changed their accents once. And why would they? 3 of the greatest voices of all time. Yeah. And never changed their voices, you know. So,
And after Rise of the Foot Soldier, we worked on another really good film together, didn't we? And do you know something, Frank? Right.
I've told you, for £1 million, I'll do the sequel.
But... This come about, and I don't know if we've ever had this conversation, right? But I was at the Cannes Film Festival, and when you go to the Cannes Film Festival, there's a book and you put your contact details in the book, and then people just randomly contact you. Go, oh, you know, I see you've got a production company, you've got a movie, come send you a script, blah, blah, blah. And then you do it. Yeah, you know, everyone's trying to hustle to get a movie off, right? And then this guy rang me and he goes, I've got the best movie, right? And I said, great, well, send me the script. He goes, no. He goes, I've got to present it to you in person because I've got to pitch this to you because you won't get it. And I've got to meet you with the lead actor, right? Now, at the time when this happened, there was these like spoofings where people would like set people up and you know, wind them up and get them to say silly things. So you watch them on telly and I can't believe they fell for it. You know, like Ant and Dec do that thing where they stitch people up. So he goes, meet me in Pizza Express on Leicester Square. And I was like, okay, at 6 o'clock. Okay. So I'm sat in Pizza Express in Leicester Square at 6 o'clock and this guy walks in. He goes, are you Terry? And I went, yeah. He goes, hi, I'm the director. I was like, nice to meet you. So he sits down and he goes, right, I'm going to pitch this movie. And I was like, okay. And what is it? And he goes, it's called Flid the Movie. And I was like, right. And I said, what's it about? And he goes, do you like Bruce Willis? And I went, yeah. And he goes, well, this is about a Flidamite martial arts expert. and I refer to him as Bruce Willis with flippers, right? So I start looking around and I'm thinking, am I being set up here? Is someone filming me? Like, you know, because I really thought it was a wind-up. And then Matt walks in. And for you, those of you that don't know, Matt Fraser is probably one of the most famous Flidamite martial arts experts, probably in the world.
Also right? A drummer, because I knew Matt from the Albany.
Yeah. So he was
a drummer in a band when I first met him.
So he walks in. Now, bear in mind, I've never met this guy, right? And then he sat down and we're having this chat. And I'm thinking, this is like the maddest thing I've ever heard, right? And he wanted to make, he's like, we've got to get £3 million to make this film. And we have helicopters blowing up and all this stuff. And I said, look, I said, genuinely, we've got to get people that back this because they want to help. He wants to be a movie star, right? He can act, he's done drama and he's done his martial arts stuff. So I said, you know, we'd have to think of a way of doing this on a low budget, right? Where, and it was actually, and I sort of politely said, I don't think I can help you, right? But then we built this platform called Film Lounge, which was a little bit like Netflix, but the problem with having a streaming platform in the early 2000s was when people wanted to watch a movie, they had to wait like 20 minutes for it to buffer, right? So I'm here in Cannes a year later and I'm talking to some people and I was chatting about the platform looking for content and someone said, oh, what you got to do is put something on there that's controversial that makes people want to watch and go on there and that's the only place I can see it. And I said, this guy's pitched me this mad idea, right? And I said, hear me out, right? So I'm telling him a story. And they just started laughing. And they said, that is the most craziest film I've ever heard in my life. You've got to make this film, but you can't call it Flid the Movie. I said, well, what would you call it? And they said, you call it the Karate Flid, right? Or Kung Fu Flid, right? So I rung up Matt and I said, look, Matt, I said, I've had some conversations, right? And do you mind us changing the title? And he goes, as long as it's got Flid in it, I don't mind. Right. So I said, okay, fine, we'll do that. So I then went out and the people that had the film then just said, look, I said, let's make this for as little as possible. I think the budget was something like 25 grand. So it wasn't a lot of money to make an actual film. And obviously anybody who's seen it would probably say it looks like it was shot on a camera. But that's because it was that you can't make a film for 25 grand, right? And I remember ringing him and he said to me, he said, Terry, he said, I really appreciate you doing this. I really want to do it. And I remember ringing people up and saying to them on the phone and them just like going, fuck off and putting the phone down. And I'm ringing them back and I'm going, because they thought I was winding them up. I'm going, no, this is a genuine project. So Google this guy, Matt Fraser, look at him online, right? This is a serious thing. And I said, I want to help him because he wants to make his movie and he's put his life, I'm selling to it. So long story short, you kindly come on the film and we had some other actors that come in, Coogan Cassius.
Who's now famous. He phoned me out the blue the other day, Coogan.
Yeah.
He phoned me out
the blue. That was his movie debut.
Right. But he's like massive now, isn't he?
He's huge on the boxing film.
Yeah.
And what was really, really good for me is making that film and being able to help somebody who's obviously, you know, he's grown up with that disability and he's never let that hamper what he wanted to do. I mean, he even had a UFC fight. Right, so the guy's been out there doing stuff, and the thing that's always made me laugh about him is he just doesn't give a fuck. And I remember when we released that film, he went to the News of the World. News of the World was going then. And literally, the press agent said, I've got an interview with News of the World. So I said, Matt, do you want me to go up with you? And I went, yeah. And we sat there and he was actually like just laughing. And he was going, he goes, I'm a flip, there's martial arts and I'll kick your ass, right? And you saw this journalist, and the journalist was like so uncomfortable. Do you know what I mean? It was just really put it on him. Mm. And he goes, I like being a flitomite. He goes, this is the card I've been, but he said, I don't let it stop me doing what I want to do. So he's obviously gone off and done this movie. And we got the film out and Anchor Bay picked it up and released it in England.
Mm.
And I remember them ringing me up and I had this really funny conversation where the guy said, look, he said, some of the retailers don't want to call it the Kung Fu Flid, right? And I said, well, it's got to have Flid in the title. And he said, honestly, they will not release it with that in. So I've rung Matt up. I went, look, Matt, I said, I know you wanted to have it in the title because you wanted to embrace it. But I said, they're just never going to release the film. So we've got to change it. And he said, what do they want to change it to? And I said, unarmed but dangerous. And he's laughing down the phone. And he goes, Terry, he goes, that's fucking brilliant. He goes, let's do it. And I remember seeing it in Tesco's and Sainsbury's on the shelves and people ringing me up going, I can't believe you made that film. I said, I've done it to help somebody. You know what I mean? I said, it's not like going to win the Oscars or BAFTAs. It's not going to further any of her acting careers. You know what I mean? Because sometimes I think you have to do things to help others. And it gave him a platform. And he's done lots of TV stuff.
Yeah.
He's done some films. He's been in some TV shows as well. So, you know, I'm happy to have helped him.
Yeah, he was a lovely guy, Matt. But like I said, my connection with Matt goes back to the Albany. I remember him being a drummer in a band.
Right.
So even then, he was that never held him back.
But that just goes to show, yeah. It doesn't matter what cards you get dealt.
Yeah.
And the thing what I loved about him is he laughed at himself. He just went, do you know, and he said, people used to come up to me and bully me and call me a flid and all this stuff, Joey Deacon and all this stuff. And he said, I got so fucking fucked off with these people bullying me. I went and just started doing kickboxing.
Yeah.
So I just started beating them up. and it just made me laugh that whatever was thrown at him, he just weren't having it.
No, it's good stuff, mate.
And he was funny. And he also does stand-up comedy as well.
Yes, yeah, right. I know he did stand-up. Yeah, no, he's good stuff, mate.
So, Matt, we love you. We haven't worked together since, but you're a good guy. And then after that, Frank, I'm trying to think, what did you do? Because you've done some others. Because was St George's Day after that?
Did St George's Day after that, yeah.
How did that come about? Because that was your director's debut, wasn't it?
Yeah, that came out of another film that never happened. We got bogged down trying to do the sequel to The Football Factory, but there was too many politics involved. Yeah. And people were throwing stuff at me. I thought, why don't I just write a gangster film that's not about anybody? It's all of, you know, just create the fictional characters because it's so much easier. Although a lot of it is probably based on things, but not actually on the nose, you know what I mean? So if you knew, you knew, you know? We went out and shot a teaser. We went out, it's like the maddest week of my life. Yeah. We all got on a coach at my local pub, went to Amsterdam and then went to Berlin, come back to Amsterdam and back home again all in a week. And that was messy.
Right.
It became known as Das Coach. It was messy to the point where one of my favourite wind-ups of all time, because we shot in Berlin and Maskell has to do this list of football firms. And at the time he was working at Northwest Kent College. So I got four or five of the students there just to say one of the names of the firms randomly. Right. They just walked past and go, wacky youth. What'd you say? The Burnley Suicide Squad. What'd you say? Nothing, Neil, nothing. What did you say? Got him at it all day. Had him at it all day before he was hearing things. But that was insane. That was an insane week. I think it was bonk. Anyway, we shot the teaser. And then I never really thought about it. But, a friend of mine, Zania Siegel, who runs a Liverpool, the agency, she was going to Cannes. Sits down on the plane, starts chatting to a guy next to her, a guy called Nick Hampson, who's a film producer. She gives him the DVD of the teaser. And then I get a phone call, wants to meet in London. And then, you know, he got the money for the film. But then you think about it, what if she's sat somewhere else? Do you know what I was frightening? Sliding doors moment. But
that was your first movie you directed, right?
Yeah, I directed it. I mean, it was, I didn't want to direct it, but I think they decided that I was the only one who could pull rank on a lot of alpha males. Right. There's a lot of alpha males flying around in that film. No, they did. I mean, they did. I always remember we wrapped in Berlin and I said to all of them, and these are people I've known a long time, I said, I love you all, but I really don't want to see you for a while. but
that's the problem when you direct a movie, because a lot of people don't realise this. You're the first one there and the last one out. Yeah. And if you've been around that, and then on the day when you're meant to be resting, you're looking at an edit or you're working out the shots or doing, you know, it's 24/7, isn't it, really?
I was very lucky on that. I was, when Mike Southern came in and interviewed to be the DOP, when he said he'd do it, I relaxed then because Mike was so experienced and he knew what he was doing. I sort of like, that's the main job. And also my first Fletch, I've met him on China when he was a third, but he trained under a guy called Bill Wesley, who was like this legendary first AD. And so once I got certain people in place, you know, it was, and it's interesting that I'd written the script and then once these people were on board, Nick and Lars, they said to me, we want you to meet a guy we know, a Swiss guy, who's a script director, a script doctor. He's like Swiss, but I think he can really push the script to another level. So
did he turn up with his little peg and his little...
Well, I remember moaning to my girlfriend at the time saying, well, what's this Swiss guy going to tell me about a British gangster film? So she said, look, it's going to be a nice day tomorrow. Just go down to Brighton, you'll get a nice lunch and a nice dinner and just, you know, just stop moaning. So I went down there, so I sat down with him and he went, he said that this is one of the best Westerns I've ever read. I went, oh my God. I thought, oh my God, he gets it. Because it's my new thing. Because it's, you know, for me, St. George Day's Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid meets Tombstone, you know. I call them neo-Western noirs is what I call them, right? So rather call them gangster film, they're neo-Western noirs.
Do you know what? I'm surprised you come without a cravat on today, Frank. You've become proper lovely
I've
now.
I've become all right lovely, haven't I? So anyway, so he sits down and he sat down and he sort of, he said, I love the characters and I love the language, but structurally. And then he went through it structurally. And I went, I've got a lot of work to do, haven't I? It was a real lesson in script writing. And I think the script went from being a good script to a really good script, you know, just swapping stuff around.
Yeah.
Just swapping scenes around.
I think the difficult thing when you're a writer, director, actor, whatever, and you've created a project, you are close to it. And sometimes you need someone to come in and go, have a look at this. And then you look at it and go, oh, actually, you're right. But it's very difficult to do it on your own.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's weird. I remember I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, and I remember saying, I don't really think I've got an ego. You've just written, directed, starred in your own film. How much ego do you want?
Was it Little Britain? Was it write the theme tune, sing the theme tune? But the thing is, though, you did it, and he did a good job. So,
yeah.
You know.
No, I mean, I think I was sort of, you know, I was, and it was great as well, because sort of everyone on the, I was quite surprised people who came in and did smaller roles for me. You know, I was really choked about that. You know, like Dexter came in and did a day. Nick Moran came in and did a day. You know, Ashley Walker did a couple of days for me. Sean Pertwee came in and did a couple of days, you know, and Jamie. So, and people often comment on the cast, you know, just when I think I've seen someone else turns up, you know. So, yeah, we had a lot of fun doing that. But I remember being absolutely exhausted. I was running on fumes, and I think the last, I had 2 days left to go, and I thought I'm out. I remember we took some special extras out to Berlin with us, so it was like a jolly up for family and friends. I mean, cousin and my brother were out there. I remember saying to my cousin, I said, I'm wet. He went to the Olympic Stadium tomorrow. I went, all right, I can do it. because that had been in my head, you know, just shooting the Olympic Stadium, so in Berlin, which was slightly surreal. Yeah, but slightly surreal.
And when you went through that process, Frank, did you get to the end of it and think, I'm never going to do this again?
Yeah.
But then after a month, you go, actually, I want to do it again.
Now, the funny thing was, we shot in the opera, outside the opera house in Berlin, brilliant steps. And that's when I got the idea of doing a Quadrophenia where the beginning of the film was the end. I'm sort of standing talking by the lion. And I thought, I want to chill out. I want to rush back. So I drove back with two location managers and got the ferry back. So it was like a couple of days just to calm down. I remember sitting on the ferry going to the girls, well, SER bit over. Was I wrong? You know, the politics then got involved with the edit and stuff like that. But the problem was that the edit that they got in to do didn't do, you know, again, just didn't do. I remember sitting watching a cut of it with Mike, and you know, that's not the film we shot.
Do you know what the problem? what the problem is with filmmaking? A lot of people, unless you've actually been through it, won't understand this. But it's so difficult to ensure you get the right people to do the right jobs. And also, sometimes you can get a great editor that just ain't right for that film,
yeah,
or doesn't get it. Yeah. And you know, we've done it on multiple films where you bring in different people and you have to change things around. And it's like a fucking Rubik's Cube. Do you know what I mean?
But I think the thing about St. George's, though, was I wanted to shoot, again, you know, I wanted to shoot it like a Western, like big, you know, and I wanted to shoot London. Yeah, so I saw it at Tower Bridge, the Belfast, St. Paul's, Greenwich. You know, I went to shoot big open spaces. And the same in Berlin. You know, I just wanted to make it look like a big film. You know, I think with the technology now, with the cameras, talking about earlier, you can get away with stuff now you couldn't have done 10 years ago. There's no way you could have done it 10 years ago.
So after St. George's Day come out, what did you... Have you done anything else, or you've been developing stuff?
Yes, I've stuff in. Like I said, I've been at the directed another feature. I've been directing stuff at this International School of Screen Acting. They're based at Three Mills, and the guy who runs it, Mark Normandy, says to me, "I've had this script." He said, "It's originally a stage play." He said, "But I'd like to film it for posterity and use like students that were graduating from the school." It was called Paper Crown. And I think the only way to describe it is Pinter meets Python. So Mark's just finishing the editing off at the moment, but it's very different. But I've got seven actors in it, graduated from school last year. They're really good.
That's amazing to be able to do that for, especially, you know, if you spend your, you know, hard-earned money and time learning how to act and then to be able to actually do a movie at the end. Yeah, I mean, that's a great...
No, it was, you know, I think hopefully it becomes a regular thing, but I did another short last year called Solitaire, which is they're trying to get out into the festivals, and I directed that. So I've been doing, you know, I've got other projects in development. I'm still acting. I've just finished one called Catching a Thief. I did that. I've done another film this year. It'll come back to me in a minute.
At least you can remember your lines, Frank. You might not be able to remember the film, but you can remember your lines.
I've done quite a bit, you know. But it's interesting now. I'm coming up with a different generation of directors. So their influences, you know, some of them, you know, were born the year Lockstock came out. It makes you feel old. It makes you feel really old, you know. But it's.
What do you think about the business now, Frank? If you look at it from what it was like to what it is now, how do you think it's changed?
Massively. I mean, funnily enough, I didn't read the article, but the headline said the industry is dead. That's Scorsese.
I mean, do you know what? I have my own view on it, right?
Yeah.
And my view on it is this: I think you've got actors that are no longer able to act, right? And if you act in something and you're not playing yourself, you get called out, right? Helen Mirren in Golda, the film that Guy and Lateef directed.
Right.
About, you know, this amazing Jewish, you know, icon of Israel, you know. Yeah. And because she wasn't Jewish, everybody's like in uproar about it. And Dame Maureen Lipman come out and said, you know, how can you play this role? You're not Jewish. And she went, well, by that rationale, you shouldn't have played any of your roles because you were playing non-Jewish people, you know. But yeah, it's ridiculous. Like the world's gone mad. And, yeah. you know, we're putting together a movie at the moment about Shah Varan. And we've already been told, you know, you need to cast Persian actors in it. You can't have people that look Persian playing Persians because obviously the cancel culture is that strict now. And it's the same with the diversity thing. You know, they're saying that you have to have this many people doing this many people doing that. You've got to, these boxes. And if you don't, and I get it, because if you have a big company like a studio, a broadcaster, a streaming platform, and you don't tick all the boxes, then you get these groups coming out saying, well, you're anti this or you're against this or you don't support this. And I think what it's done, it's made everybody nervous and everybody's tipping around on eggshells. They don't know what to do, what they can do, what they can't do. And everyone's becoming cautious. And obviously the whole point of films is they're meant to shock. They're meant to, you know, you normally come out of a film and talk about it and go, wow, did you see this performance? Or fucking hell, I didn't realise it was going to end like that. But it feels like everything's been softened and it feels like the actors aren't able to act and everybody has to kind of make sure they're ticking the boxes. And if they don't tick all the boxes, they could be in trouble. And they could make a film now and then next year, somebody could be upset about it.
The only company that seems not to bother with that, and that's why they make the best television, is HBO.
Yeah.
I mean, I just watched someone said to me, what's the greatest TV show of all time? Sopranos. And I suddenly realised I hadn't watched it for 6 or 7 years. So I went back and revisited during the lockdown because we had nothing else to do. And after watching it, I thought, no, it is the greatest TV show.
I mean, if you look at HBO, Sopranos, Succession, I mean, whatever
I've
they do.
I just watched that Lakers Winning Time with John C. Wright. And now I don't like basketball, but right. That is brilliant.
See, I'm a massive fan of HBO.
Yeah.
And I think if you look around, they
don't worry about being politically correct. I mean, the great thing about Sopranos is the Sopranos works because it's not politically correct. And again, they're gangsters.
Right. I genuinely think, what you said earlier when about St. George's Day, when you said, what did you say? You said, you didn't say it when we was talking about it, but you said it when we was chatting earlier about St. George's Day.
Well, I know that film got a lot of people dismissed that film before they'd even seen it because of the title.
Right.
And to me, it was no different than calling the film The Long Good Friday.
But again, it's like, you know, St. George's Day, right? You know, people had St. George's Day flags up and St. George's Day, and then people went, oh, they're far right, they're racist or whatever. And it's like, well, it's just a flag. Do you know what I mean? But I think this goes back to, you know, what we were saying earlier, that people, you know, look at things to be offended by. So, you know, when they took that Golda Meir film to Berlin, the director said he had 50 journalists there. And all they want to talk about is, why have you cast a non-Jewish person in a Jewish role? They weren't interested in the film. They weren't interested in the 3 or 4 years he spent trying to pull it together. And that to me is, you know, it's kind of worrying because you sort of think if you're not allowed to be creative,
yeah,
whether you're an actor, whether you're a director, whether you're a writer, whether you're a producer, it doesn't matter. Whatever you're doing, if you're being told, and this is one of the reasons why I come out of the club scene, right?
Yeah.
Because towards the end, the gun crime and all the violence got so bad that you had people going, oh, who's DJing? And then you'd be going, well, you can't have him, you can't have them. So it was like, well, so I can't actually do what I want to do. So I was like dancing to their tune. And obviously it feels a little bit like that now where it's sort of like, you know, if you want to get this off, you've got to tick these boxes. And if you want to do this, you've got to have these people and you can't have him in it. You can't have them playing this. You have to have them playing it because otherwise you're going to upset these people. And it seems like it's being overcomplicated and you're not getting your people's creativity is being stifled. So I think the content you're getting, occasionally there's some amazing content that comes out and there's things that come out and you go, wow, what a great movie, right? But then there's other things that just feel a bit same old, you know?
Well, I always remember, now I don't read reviews, right? I got a good review off of Barry Norman in 1998 and decided to quit while I was in front.
He's great, Barry Norman.
He was brilliant.
Great.
But I grew up with Barry Norman. But yeah, I got Baz had given me a good
review.
Was he
on the telly or did he write in the paper?
No, he used to do things. So whatever year it was, that'd be like Film 94 or Film 95.
So I remember him, but I'm trying to remember the context.
So he did, it was BBC, he was always, I think Sunday nights it was on. Anyway, he gave me a good review a long time ago. I thought, that's it, I'm quitting while I'm in front. But when someone said that there was a review of St. George's Day and they didn't like the film. And I thought, well, that's fair enough. If you don't like the film, you don't like it. Right at the end of it, they threw a throwaway remark saying this film could be construed as racist. I'm thinking, it's got a black gospel choir in it.
Right.
You know, it's like, what? It's you know, it's stuff like that. You know, and also, my character constantly quoted Churchill. The only person my character quotes in the entire film is John Lennon. you know, life is something that happens to you while you're busy making other plans. It was John Lennon. You know, so, and you just feel, I'm hiding for nothing now. But I think that there's a, people say there's two types of films that people, there's three types of films, three genres that will always work. One's crime, which I think we've proved over the years. Two's horror. And the other's a rom-com, but you've got to have Jennifer Aniston in it.
Yeah.
You know.
For a lot of money.
For a lot of money, yeah. But I guess that's sort of... But
I mean, if you look at crime, right, this is why we're doing the Criminal Connection podcast, right? If you look at all the great shows on Netflix, Gomorra, Breaking Bad, Narcos, El Chapo, it's all crime, right?
Yeah.
If you look at Amazon, same thing, the Power universe, you know? So...
Well, I think it's always thought it's psychological, you know, because it's like the most of us live within the law because the thought of going to prison terrified me, you know. So I think, and that's most people live within the law. They might do little things, but most people have not got it in them to go and really break the law, go and do something that would get you a long prison spell. So I think they're obsessed with people who do. Or
yeah, well, it's like, why is true crime the biggest genre in the world? Whether it's a book, whether it's a film, whether it's a TV show, you know, and I just genuinely think people like watching men and women
breaking the law.
Badly. same things that they want to say, but they know they can't. So.
but it goes all the way back to Robin Hood, didn't it, really, if you think about it? You know. But no, I remember as a kid, like, even growing up, when I was growing up, you know, I was obsessed with, they had like these spoof, well, recreation wanted posters. And I remember in my bedroom having Wanted Dead or Alive, Jesse James. You know, so it's always been there.
Because when you grew up, you was in South London, weren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, did you, was there a lot of crime when you was growing up?
Yeah. 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 But I mean, I think I it was weird because I think I was sort of sheltered from it a little bit, but you know, because I grew up in a place called Downham. But as my mates always remind me, I grew up on the posh part of the Downham estate.
I said your little finger out when you drank your tea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I didn't, because Downham and Bellingham are these two huge housing estates that were built in the 1930s. And both sides of my family were bombed out from Peckham and Bermondsey and landed in Bellingham, which is sort of the estate next to Downham. So that's sort of where I grew up. I mean, someone says, was it rough? I said, well, no, it wasn't rough. It was tough. And there's a difference. Some places you go, you know, for argument's sake, where I grew up, women wouldn't think about going shopping in their slippers or dressing gown. They get dressed up and put some lippy on. Do you know what I mean? That's the difference. The difference between saying that's rough and saying it's tough.
No, so the rough they dress up, or is it the tough that they dress up?
The tough they dress up.
Right, okay, yeah. But the rough they just wear the cigarette curlers.
Yeah, slippers. You see people going shopping in their slippers and their dressing gown. Like, I can't drop me out. You know what I mean? Make an effort. I can't. That's my future son-in-law. He was first time I met him. I've gone out for some lunch with my daughter, and I'm moaning about people wearing shorts in restaurants.
And he turned up in shorts.
He's
right?
got a pair of shorts on. He doesn't want to stand up. Yeah, oh, I don't understand. Yeah. But no, but you do find some.
You're part of the problem.
You're part of the problem. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean it was. But I think it was. No, I enjoy. I mean, the one thing I sort of, I never thanked my mother and father for giving me a really good childhood. I was very lucky, you know, and it was quite exciting because my dad was playing professional football. So school holidays, I'd go pre-season training, which was like, it's even then it was slightly different, you know, and obviously where I grew up, the fact that he played for Millwall was a massive advantage. Second time at Daniel Day-Lewis, I walked into the rehearsal room in Dublin. He said, come on, well, I went, yeah. He said, you never told me your dad played for Millwall. I said, I didn't think you'd be interested. He went, I'm a Millwall supporter, Frank. Well, I grew up in Greenwich, it's the safest option. He is a Millwall supporter.
So Daniel Day-Lewis is a Millwall supporter. You heard it here first.
I've got a better one than that. So going right back to for Queen of Country, the film's about a black British paratrooper, a Falklands veteran, who didn't apply in time because he was born in the West Indies, couldn't get a passport. That's what the film's about. It's based on a true story. So Denzel comes over, and this is very early in his career. It was just before he just finished doing Biko and was going back to the States to do Glory, the Civil War film, which got him his first Oscar. But Denzel being Denzel said, well, look, I keep hearing about Millwall. I've got to go to Millwall. So Tim Bevan and that guy ain't going to Millwall. This is the old Den. So Trix Warwell co-written and said, well, if he wants to go, he can go with Frank. He'll probably be safe with Frank, probably. So there's this urban myth that Denzel Washington went to the old Den. It's not a myth. He did. He stood next to me. Right. And we're in the Coblo Lane end. And we were playing Leeds, so it was a lively game. And he stood there after about 20 minutes. I said, you're right. He went, now I know what it must have been like to be in the Coliseum when they were feeding Christians the lions. And because it became a sort of urban myth. But I think recently he'd come out to promote a film and said, do you follow football? He said, not really. He said, but if I supported anyone, it'd be Millwall. So Millwall supporters have got more Oscars than anyone else put together.
Well, there you go. So Daniel Day-Lewis and
Denzel Washington.
I mean,
Michael Caine and Gary Oldman.
Wow. So that's great. I mean, imagine having those four on a Saturday.
But I don't have it. But no, that became an urban myth about Denzel. That's not a myth.
That is good. So Denzel Washington is a Millwall fan.
So is Daniel Day.
he knows all the songs.
He knows all the songs, yeah. Yeah.
But, what is a Millwall song?
No one likes us, we don't care.
No one likes us, we don't care.
I managed to get that line at me and Fairbrass since St George's Day, didn't I? Right. Yeah. Brilliant. The other thing we had to, because Ronnie Fox is a really good mate of mine, and from like Lockstock, Ronnie coming into the pit in St George's Day, and the idea is that him and this other guy get knocked off and end up, they find them in a bin. We had a shot of them in the bin, so we had this massive bin to put them in, but I squeezed Ronnie in a little small one.
He fucking loves you.
No, because he's West Ham and he's just.
So you're probably one and you're in a small box because you're West Ham.
Yeah. It's got to be some sort of wind up. Like, yeah, it is one coming out. You bring that one over there. No, we had some fun on that. It was great filming in Amsterdam, and Berlin's a great city to film. It's very cinematic. They've got the filmed at the Brandenburg Gate and stuff like that. And the Germans are they're so efficient. It's like we were filming a scene and we was on top of the TV tower in Berlin. So that gives you a panoramic view of Berlin. But you're only allowed X amount of people on the roof and you're paying by the hour. So I think it was me, Fairbrass, Vince and Sura, who's playing the courier. So we all get there and camera truck ain't there. So my first is phoning, where's the camera truck? No, it's on its way. It's on its way because it was based at the hotel. Hour later, still no camera truck. Right. Phone the hotel. I said, tell whoever's there to go and knock him up. He's probably overslept. Go and knock on his door. Anyway, this goes on 3 hours. He finally turns up the camera truck. And the guy who's driving has got a suit on. It's 10 o'clock in the morning.
That's why it took him 3 hours to get there, because he was getting ready for you, Frank.
So my first said to me, he said, what must the Germans think of us? I said, they must be thinking, how the hell did we lose 2 World Wars to this lot? Am I allowed to say that?
I think you are. I think you are. It's funny.
No, they were brilliant. They had a great time in Berlin. Fantastic city. Yeah, really good city. Yeah. It was a lot of fun doing that film, but exhausting. Yeah, I was running on empty at the end. But that was good. It was good. So yeah, hopefully do it again. I mean, sort of dip my toe back in. I took a couple of years out. I just took a break from it. You know, I think when you've been doing it, when you realise, you know, you've been doing it that long.
How long have you actually been an actor?
Well, this is, so my next year will be the 40th anniversary of my professional debut at the Albany.
You got to do something big for that, Frank. Rise of the Foot Soldier in space.
I think we should do Rise of the Foot Soldier. Rise of the Foot Soldier, the musical. I think that's what's calling me at the moment. I think, yeah, we could shoot him in a song and dance routine. Yeah, I think that's what's calling to me.
Ricky Arnott was a professional dancer.
Was he really?
Yeah, before he became an actor. So maybe we could get him
some tips. Yeah. Now, so I've got lots of stuff going on. Amazing. Yeah, I'm looking sort of, I'm still sort of trying to keep busy.
Yeah. Well, Frank, it's been an honour to have you on, mate. And I think we've shared some funny stories, some great stories.
Can I tell you my best showbiz story?
Go on, then.
So
I thought Denzel and... You can't trump that, surely.
So I'm doing 24-7 in Nottingham with Bob Hoskins, right? Bob was a lovely, down-to-earth man. And someone said to Bob, you know, you're just such a nice, ordinary fella. So what keeps your feet on the ground? So Bob went, London cab drivers. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I'll only get the black cab. So I'm only going to get the black cab. So anyway, he said, I'll get this cab. He said, I've been invited to a party, a drinks party, at Michael Caine's penthouse in Chelsea Harbour. So I'll call a cab to come pick, black cab to come pick me up at St John's Wood. So I'm getting in the cab, and I'll get in the cab. I say to the cab driver, Brewer Street, Chelsea Harbour, mate. Cab driver says to me, Brewer Street? He went, yeah, Brewer Street, Chelsea Harbour. So cab size, jump in. So it's 5 o'clock on Friday night. It's chucking it down with rain. So Bob's in the, you know, Bob at the time is one of the most famous actors, not just in this country, in the world. So Bob said, I'm in the cab for an hour. And we talk about everything. We talk about the weather, politics, football. It's chucking down the rain. But at no point does this cab driver mention anything to do with the fact he's got Bob Hoskins in the cab. He said, fine, we get to the World's End in the King's Road, stop at the lights, and the cab driver says to Bob, mate, it's been doing my head in since you got in the cab. You're going to have to give me a clue. So Bob goes, well, I'm an actor. So the cab driver gives him a look. He says, well, Bob Hoskins, Long Good Friday, Who Killed Roger Rabbit, Mona Lisa. And the cab driver says to him, I know you are soppy bollocks. Where's Brewer Street in Chelsea Harbour?
I'm going to share Bob Hoskins' story with you, Frank, as well, right?
Go on.
And he, we did a, his last.
Oh, because he did a film with you. Yeah, it was his last film, wasn't it? Yeah.
And he was ill. I mean, when he came on the set, he didn't really know where he was. Yeah. He was still good fun. He was still top jaw.
Was Sammy with him?
Sammy's
driver.
I think so.
Yeah, he wouldn't. Yeah.
So. But this was like 2012.
Yeah.
Just before he died, and he was like really good fun. I had a real laugh with him. And what happened was we was on this film, there was about 45 of us in this room, and there was Jen Agata, there was Bob, Dudley Sutton, RIP Dudley Sutton.
Oh, Dudley, yeah.
There was Rita Tushenham. There was like all these, like, and my mate said to me, he said, fucking hell, he said, He said, this is like a pinch me moment. He said, you've got like fucking actors from here to here,
yeah,
the new, the old, the old, you know. He said, this is an amazing thing. And Adam Deacon was on his phone. And Bob looked at him and he went, why are you on your phone? He goes, oh, he goes, I'm updating my social media, Bob. He goes, social media. He goes, you're at work. Just turn your fucking phone off, right? And then he goes, what do you do on social media? And he goes, well, I like post videos and pictures and talking about things, what I do and all that. And he goes, how many followers you got? he says something like 380,000. And Bob goes, what fucking sad world we live in. And got up and walked out. And he was sort of sat there and he went, sorry, Bob. He just turned his phone off. But he was just so funny, Bob. You know what I mean?
That was good stuff. But no, I think that was a really memorable time. That first film I did in Nottingham, Shane's first film with Bob.
But that was when he was well. I mean, when he was with us, you could see that he whatever was wrong with him, he was struggling.
Yeah.
He was struggling.
But no, it was a wonderful, really good time. But he's a very generous man. He'd suddenly, we'd be in a restaurant and he'd disappear, he'd come back and go, what about the bill? And I've done it. We make a big thing about it, just do it.
I remember at the time, my son was fairly young and he'd watched that Roger Rabbit film, Roger Rabbit. And I said, I'm working with Bob. He's actually on a movie. He said, oh, can I meet him? And I took him in and Bob sat with him and spoke to him and said all about the film, what it was like and blah, blah, blah. And I just thought, you know, he was very generous with his time.
He was a lovely man. You know, but I think as well, I think I've been lucky. All the big stars I've met have been nice people. Yeah. You know, I was really worried about Kane. I thought, I remember sitting in my mum and dad's pub in the kitchen and we was going to do the press conference. He said, you're right. I said, oh, I hope he's not horrible. Yeah. And he wasn't. He was complete opposite. You know, he was a...
Well, they say you should always... You shouldn't really meet your heroes, but I think normally you find the people that are arses are normally the ones that aren't there.
Well, I think when you're as big a star as them, you've got nothing to prove. You know, I mean, we did a scene. Martin Lando came over to play the American promoter, so there's this first scene between Michael and Martin, and me and Andy are sort of walking with Michael. And we're talking to Martin Landau. I think this is a man who dated Marilyn Monroe and shared a flat with James Dean.
Was he in Space 1999?
He was, yes. He was.
I grew up on that shit. Yeah. I love that.
So anyway, we were doing this scene. So the first calls turn over. So you know you've got like 10 seconds between that and action. So the first call turn over and Michael Caine looked at me and Andy Serkis went, you're just about to do a scene with two Academy Award winners. No pressure. Action. Anyway, we get round the corner, he drives, right? So he turns around, looks at me and Andy, we went, Michael, no pressure. No, it's good stuff, Michael Caine.
Nah, brilliant.
He's
90, I think he's 91, 90,
isn't he?
Yeah, he's still going.
Still going, yeah.
Still going.
He's the last, him and Clint Eastwood, they're the last two, weren't they?
Clint Eastwood, though, phenomenal actor. Phenomenal. Director, yeah. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Just shows, Frank, you're never too old, mate. You'd still be going another 30 years.
Well, no, listen. In touch woods. Is that wood, Sal?
Yeah. But Frank, no, seriously, thank you for coming.
It's been a pleasure reminiscing.
Yeah.
Because I try to look back too much. If you look back and you're trying to go forward, you fall over.
If you hadn't done anything, I'd say don't look back, look forward. But you've done loads, so it's good to remember the good old days. And I mean, you know, lots of people will now see this and they'll be like, fucking hell, I didn't know he was in this, I didn't know he was in that. And, you know, the stories you've given us today are phenomenal. Have you done a podcast before?
No.
Oh, so Dr. Jerry, Frankie, baby.
Hey, Dr. Jerry.
So thank you for tuning in to the Criminal Connection podcast. Frank Harper, what a guest, what a legend. Make sure you tune in next week. We've got some more exciting guests.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. and it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.